In the 1950s, many of New York's teachers and academics became targets of the anti-communist sentiment that swept the nation. Some felt that they had little choice but to cooperate with the investigations, purges, and loyalty programs. Others resisted at great personal and professional cost. Civil liberties lawyer Marjorie Hines tells the story of the Red Scare in academia and the landmark Supreme Court rulings on academic freedom in her new book called Priests of Our Democracy. It's published by NYU Press. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
You write that the story of academic freedom in the United States is intimately tied to the story of the American left. Only the American left, really?
Primarily. If you go back to the beginnings, early part of the 20th century, professors mostly on the left who were supporters of the labor movement, opponents of child labor, are being summarily fired by their universities. And that that really motivates the professoriate to get together and start advocating for academic freedom.
Of course, there have been battles about academic free speech throughout history, going back all the way to Socrates, and probably
yes.
Earlier. I don't know whether Socrates was a leftist. I don't think so.
But no. In fact, he opposed the democracy of Athens. He was a fan of Sparta.
Now, after World War II, the United States was the most powerful country in the world. Why were we so consumed by this anti-communist fervor?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, the Soviet Union had emerged as the other great power, and certainly the Soviet Union was a totalitarian society and expansionist. So there was a genuine threat in terms of the balance of world power. But
And there had been real spying done.
There had been, and some of that started to come out in the period just after the war ended. That did not help American communists. But the campaign to purge all fields of American life, including academia and education, K-12 education, the attack on domestic communists, ex-communists, people who were thought to be sympathizers, people who might have joined or supported a front organization, such as a civil rights organization or a group to aid the refugees after the Spanish Civil War, people who'd been involved in the fight against fascism domestically as well as abroad, were under attack. And the argument was that they posed a threat of revolution and subversion in the United States, which was greatly exaggerated, to say the least.
People who had been involved in the Spanish Civil War were called premature anti-fascists.
You're right, people who went over there.
But it even reached to the point where if you signed a petition calling for peace or something like that, you were under suspicion.
Well, once the loyalty investigation started, and the reason my book focuses so much on New York is it turned out a lot of the several of the most important Supreme Court cases in this period came out of New York. A lot of the most severe repression, especially against teachers and professors, happened in New York, in part in response to the fact that New York had been a very active center of left activism.
We have somebody calling in who went through this, so I'm going to go right to him. Lee from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
You're talking to me?
Yes.
Leo.
Leo, I'm sorry. Leo, do you want to tell us what happened to you?
Yes, I was teaching at Queens College at the time. There were five of us who were called to investigating committees, two to federal committees, and three to a committee that had been established by the Board of Higher Education. All the others were really revered teachers in the school. I was a kind of a minor victim. I did not have tenure at the time, but I was a red diaper baby, so to speak, and I had been a member of the Young Communist League and the Communist Party until about 1948. And so I was advised by the union that I should resign the job because, of course, if I went to testify, I would have to name other people's names, which, of course, I wouldn't do. because I didn't believe, no matter what, that a communist did not deserve the right to teach at that time.
Now, you had left the party by this time.
In 1948, I was actually expelled from the party for a kind of heresy. But I remained a left, liberal person the rest of my life. I'm 89 years old now.
Well, what was so appealing to academics about the party for someone like you? Many people from that time had been disillusioned with the Soviet Union after Stalin signed the peace treaty with Hitler. That many left the party at that point.
That's true. I was at that time, at the time of the pact, a member of the Young Communist League, and I actually resigned from it for that reason at that time. But when I went to City College in 1939, there was a big purge, anti-communist purge at that time there, too. It was called the Rapkuder Committee, and so I rejoined. And I remained in the party. I went to war in World War II, and after I came back, I stayed in it until 1948, when I was expelled for reasons. I don't want to take your time with all of that.
Okay, well, does Leo's story sound typical?
Very much so. In fact, two of the people I write about at some length in Priests of Our Democracy are people Leo will recognize, Vera Schlachman and Oscar Schaftel. Vera Schlachman was a prominent labor historian. She'd written an important book on a company town. She was a very popular teacher. But she was also an officer in the teachers' union, which Leo mentioned. And this was a radical union which had been a thorn in the side of the New York City Board of Education for a long time, trying to get them to, for example, eliminate racist textbooks in the schools. And some of them, which I quote, were really quite shocking. So Schlachman is called before the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, which has come to town in 1952 primarily to try to force the Board of Higher Education, which administered the four free municipal colleges, City, Queens, Brooklyn, and Hunter, try to force them to do what the City Board of Education was already doing with a vengeance to teachers in the K-12 system, really calling in anybody who was, number one, a leader of the teachers' union, number two, whose name had been given. They might have gotten the name from the FBI, from a congressional committee, might have been somebody who'd been called to testify before Rapkuder in 1940, 41, and subject them to a very extensive interrogation about all their past political associations, present, what books they read, what magazines they subscribed to, what concerts they went to, what petitions they had signed, did they vote for the American Labor Party? The questioning was very extensive. So...
Well, the American Labor Party was a liberal party.
It was
but
a left
wasn't
liberal
a communist
party. It was a left liberal party. Certainly, communists participated. But the Communist Party in the 1930s was, admittedly, it had a fatal flaw. It adhered to what Stalin wanted, and people rationalized. Took a long time to fully comprehend that the Soviet Union was not a utopia. But on the domestic front, they were in the forefront of every progressive battle.
Now, Leo, what were you teaching?
I was in the economics department at the time.
At which school?
Queens College.
Uh-huh.
I knew Vera Schlachman was a revered teacher at Queens College at the time. Oscar Schaftel, who also was called before the Federal Committee, was a revered teacher. And so were the other two people who were called when I was called. We were called by the Board of Higher Education. They were revered teachers. There was no reason for those people to lose their jobs.
Well, I guess one of the concerns was that they were teaching communist propaganda.
This was the argument, and in fact, a law that the New York State Legislature passed in 1949 called the Feinberg Law, the preamble says, we don't really have any evidence of indoctrination, was the term they used. But just because we don't have that evidence, that just means it's so subtle we can't detect it.
No.
And so that was the accusation. That was the excuse. But in fact, it was an attempt to bust the teachers' union for sure. And it was an attempt to, in fact, indoctrinate, to force a kind of silence of left-wing dissent against any of the Cold War policies, and to force the teachers to adopt a style of indoctrination.
You mentioned that there had been hearings in 1940-41. That was before the Soviet Union became our ally against Hitler. So during the period when we were allied, did everything stop?
Everything slowed down considerably. There had been plenty of anti-communist agitation in the late 30s, really in response to the success of the Communist Party.
There had been a number of previous Red Scares.
Yes, there was certainly a very intense one just after World War I, the Palmer Raids and so forth. The McCarthy era was the longest and the most intense and had the longest and most devastating effect.
So for a brief period, we were allied with the Soviet Union and things slowed down. How soon after the end of the war did they heat up again?
Very soon. I mean, there was 1946, we have Winston Churchill's famous Iron Curtain speech, and the Cold War begins. But interestingly, only in America did the war against domestic leftists become as severe. 1946 also, as the book tells the story, Mayor William O'Dwyer appoints a lawyer named George Timone to the City Board of Education. And Timone had been active in pro-fascist circles in New York, pro-Mussolini rallies in the late 30s. He is put on the Board of Education with no real educational credentials. And it wasn't Timone alone who was responsible for the vociferousness with which the New York Board of Education went after people, but he certainly spearheaded investigations.
Well, what you're pointing out here is that it wasn't just the House Un-American Activities Committee and the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee. It wasn't just Joe McCarthy and some people in Washington, but there were state and city agencies also taking part in the communist hunting, the Board of Education, the Board of Regents.
The Board of Education actually got started before this Feinberg Law in 1949. Superintendent William Jansen was starting to call people in, and they were all leaders of the teachers' union, demanding that they answer questions about Communist Party affiliation, past or present, and a whole host of other questions. And when they refused, saying that their professional qualifications should be based on their competency as teachers, and some of these teachers were in fields far from any possible opportunity to influence students' political activities, kindergarten teachers, math teachers, and so forth, when they refused to answer questions essentially based on a First Amendment argument, they were brought up on charges of insubordination and conduct unbecoming a teacher. So they were, for the most part, none of them were ever actually charged with communism. And ultimately, the people started getting fired for insubordination, and for everyone who actually got fired, dozens more resigned or took early retirement because they didn't want to be subjected to this. And as Leo said, the inevitable question would be, name everybody else you ever saw at a meeting. And a lot of people had serious ethical problems with that one.
Were they already being asked to sign loyalty oaths?
There were a variety of oaths that predated the McCarthy era. Ultimately, as the book recounts, the Board of Regents, which administered the state university educational system, decides that there's going to be an oath to enforce the Feinberg Law, because this law required massive loyalty investigations of tens of thousands of people. So why not just have them sign an oath? And that ultimately led to a challenge in the late 60s, in the mid-60s.
Well, that's a long time afterward. What did the oath ask you to
basically
say?
First of all, I understand all the terms of the loyalty program as conditions of my employment, which basically required not being a member of any organization that was on any of a number of lists that the government had created, and not writing or engaging in any activity that could be considered seditious, and then that I'm not a member of the Communist Party and never have been, and if I ever was, I've told the university president about it. That was essentially the Feinberg certificate.
Had there been similar attempts to weed out fascists and Nazi sympathizers?
No. actually, and when you look at what the Board of Education was doing, the treatment, the double standard that was involved in terms of, there was one famous case of a fascist sympathizer teacher named Mae Quinn, about whom the teachers' union complained numerous times that she was basically preaching anti-Semitism in the classroom. She was never really punished for that.
My guest is Marjorie Hines, H-E-I-N-S, a civil liberties lawyer, writer, and teacher, and the founding director of the Free Expression Policy Project. Her latest book, Priests of Our Democracy, The Supreme Court, Academic Freedom, and the Anti-Communist Purge, is published by NYU Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Marjorie Hines. Her book, Priests of Our Democracy, The Supreme Court, Academic Freedom, and the Anti-Communist Purge. It is published by NYU Press. So the Feinberg Law is enacted in New York State. Is it one of the first laws enacted in this country, or were states doing it all over the place?
States were doing it all over the place since before World War I. And in fact, the Feinberg Law piggybacks on two earlier New York State laws, first one from the World War I era, which basically said no teacher is qualified to teach if they utter any treasonable or seditious utterances or engage in any treasonable or seditious activities, not really defined. Second law comes in 1939, as we were talking about, late 30s, another period of anti-communist activity. And it says no civil servant shall be qualified to continue in their job if they support the overthrow of the government by unlawful means. So basically, to hold revolutionary beliefs, whether you intend to do anything illegal or not. But there was no mechanism to investigate people. So the Feinberg Law gets passed in
49. Was there much debate in the state legislature?
No, not at all. And it's really modeled on the loyalty program for federal employees that President Truman sets up in 1947 and basically establishes this huge bureaucracy to investigate the loyalty of every federal employee.
If a teacher hadn't been a member of the party, hadn't signed the petition, but said something in a classroom that somebody took offense at, would that also lead to problems?
It could well, because, you know, there's a wonderful dissent by William Douglas. In the first 5-6 years of the anti-communist purge post-World War II, before Joe McCarthy is even a name on the scene, the Supreme Court is affirming basically everything that's going on, whether it's a legislative investigative committee or a Board of Education loyalty program. And when the Feinberg Law gets challenged, gets up to the Supreme Court in 1952, Supreme Court upholds it, basically says, you don't have a right to a job. They can ask you anything you want. If you don't like it, go back to where you came from, essentially. Douglas writes this very prophetic dissent in which he says this law turns the school system into a spying project. And people, parents, students, teachers, all will be informing on each other or worried about what they say. You know, why did the teacher make a favorable reference to socialism? Why did the teacher teach the grapes of wrath? So the Douglas dissent lays out the entire problem.
So teaching the grapes of wrath could get you in trouble.
It could indeed. Yeah, and Oscar Schaftel also mentions the grapes of wrath when he is talking to the Board of Higher Education and trying to argue why he shouldn't be fired for refusing to cooperate with this federal investigating committee. He says, you know, the real damage is we are now the laughingstock of Europe, he says. I see college professors rushing around like Keystone Cops trying to placate these committees and professors afraid to teach the grapes of wrath.
Which is interesting because the movie of The Grapes of Wrath was directed by a conservative, John Ford. Nobody, I guess, pointed that out at the time. So do we know how many teachers and professors in New York lost their careers as a result of this?
Only approximately because, as I mentioned, lots of people resigned. Leo was an example. He was advised to, rather than testify, be forced to name names, be put in a position where you're probably going to lose your job anyway, or make these lavish confessions of your political errors in the past. But In the Board of Education system, there were almost 300, the best estimates of historians are, most of whom did not go through formal proceedings and get formally fired. And in the higher education system, there was a big purge around the time of Rapp Crudaire, 1941. City College mostly got the worst of it. About 50 people lost their jobs. Then in the early 50s, you have at least several dozen that I know of, like Vera Schlachman and Oscar Schaftel, who refused to cooperate with the committee. But I don't have numbers for how many hundreds of people left the system, were probationary employees, didn't get tenure, and so forth.
Some people have argued that there was an anti-Semitic side to who was being targeted, to the point where there was a Washington administrator named Anna Rosenberg. She'd worked for Roosevelt. She had nothing to do with the Communist Party, but she came under attack simply because her name sounded very much like two people who had been convicted of spying.
Yeah, well, certainly anti-Semitism played a role, not always overt, but there were occasions when it was overt. And that comes from a time in our history when anti-Semitism was very common and much more accepted. And the overwhelming majority of teachers who were leaders in the teachers' union, who had been close to or around communist activities in the 30s, especially in New York, were Jewish.
We have we've been talking about teachers, but what about students? Evelyn from Manhattan has just called in to talk about her experience at Hunter College, was it?
Yes.
What was happening? How were students afraid as well?
Yes, absolutely. I was a student at Hunter College, 1946, 47, 48. And those of us who were politically more or less active, as I was, we were very careful not to join any of the certainly not the communist party organization which existed at Hunter, but some of the others, and I wish I could remember the names. I don't know whether Americans for Democratic Action was one, but we were quite careful. And I know that one of my teachers, my Greek teacher, a harmless old lady, I remember her well. Excuse me. And she sort of in the middle of the semester disappeared. And we knew, because students sort of knew these things, that she had been fired for left-wing activities that we know nothing about. She certainly never showed anything in class. President Shuster, who was the president of Hunter, was known, again, among the students, this is talk, of being one who was looking for anybody who might have had any left-wing associations.
Weren't all of the heads of the city colleges involved in some way? Perhaps the most famous was Harry Gideons at Brooklyn College.
He was certainly the most famous and the most aggressive. John Theobald at Queens was certainly up in the same category. But one of the sad things about the Board of Higher Education, as I said, from the period of Rapp Crudaire until the early 50s, they had not been nearly as aggressive as the Board of Education. And in fact, the head of the Board of Higher Education, Ordway Teed, had said in response to HUAC accusations of communist activity in the city colleges in the late 30s, "We welcome diversity. It's good for the students to be exposed to a variety of viewpoints." Sounded great, but he was not able to maintain that once the federal investigating committees started descending on the city. So even if President Shuster at Hunter might have wanted to protect the teachers, he was under tremendous pressure.
And what about students? Student groups were also targeted?
Yes, they were. And in fact, one of the stories about Brooklyn College is that it was really the students in the 30s who were the most active, interested in Communist Party, working on anti-fascism campaigns, and they recruited some of the professors into the Communist Party at Brooklyn.
On the other hand, weren't the schools vulnerable? I'd imagine that since, especially the schools that were publicly funded, that they had to rely on the state, the city, the federal government to give them money.
Well, they were vulnerable, and you're reminding me now of what just happened at Brooklyn College 2 weeks ago, where, again, several members of the city council threatened the funding of Brooklyn College because they didn't like one program that was being planned.
BDS's performance there. They did a presentation.
Yeah, the student group had invited two advocates of the movement to establish a boycott of Israel in protest against Israeli policies in the occupied territories. So this threat of withdrawal of funding has been a persistent theme of censorship of all kinds.
On the other hand, if I were to say something here at WMIC that was deemed offensive to the management, or if I were to say something on the air that was considered offensive by most listeners, I would be in danger of losing my job as well, wouldn't I? How is that any different?
Sure. Well, and you might get in trouble with Congress as well. So certainly
public
radio has had the same issues. Obviously, an employer has the authority to, in general, control the public statements of its employees to the extent those public statements are part of the job. So that, for example, the press secretary for a college has to toe the line of the president of the college. But that doesn't mean every teacher in the classroom has to conform to a particular political orientation.
So
that's where academic freedom comes in, actually.
So what happened to people who were forced out? Did they find it difficult to get jobs outside of academia? Were there other schools in the country that were willing to hire them?
You know, it runs the gamut. I mean, Irving Adler, who was a math teacher and an activist in the teachers' union, whose name now graces that Supreme Court case that upheld the Feinberg Law. He was a very brilliant mathematician and a very gifted teacher, and he was able to make a lot more money afterwards writing books about math and science for children. But, you know, he lost the opportunity. Not everybody fared so well. There were a lot of psychological pressures on families. People were under surveillance by the FBI. And most importantly, people whose vocation was to teach lost that opportunity, and the students lost the gift of some of these very talented teachers.
So there was a second challenge to the Feinberg Law, but now we're talking about the 60s when attitudes were changing.
Attitudes are changing, but we're still in the Cold War. What happens is 1962, the University of Buffalo, private university, gets absorbed into the state university system, the SUNY system. And suddenly all the staff and faculty is confronted with this Feinberg certificate. And here's one of the wonderful stories from the book is one of the young instructors at Buffalo was a guy named Harry Kayashian. And Harry had been a student at Queens College in 1952 when Leo was there and Vera Schlachman and Oscar Schaftel and a number of other teachers who were very popular and very talented were summarily fired. And Harry is sort of politicized by this. And 10 years later, he's at Buffalo confronted with this oath. And he's never had any involvement with communism, but he sees it, as he said, as his opportunity to have his revenge on the 50s. And he is one of ultimately five professors at Buffalo who refuses to sign this. And they bring a new legal challenge to the Feinberg Law.
And the Supreme Court rules differently this time.
Although you wonder how
it would rule today.
Well, I talk about this toward the end of the book.
Quickly.
Right. The Kayashian case comes out in 1967. Justice Brennan writes the opinion. He says this whole Feinberg Law is unconstitutional, and academic freedom is a special concern of the First Amendment, and we can't have a pole of orthodoxy over the classroom. 2006, the U.S. Supreme Court, now the Roberts Court, casts doubt on that basic proposition.
Marjorie Hines will be speaking at Brooklyn College tomorrow, February 19th at 3:40 p.m. That's at the Jefferson Williams Lounge at Brooklyn College Student Center at Campus Road at East 27th Street in Brooklyn. Find out more information on our show page at WNYC.org. Her book, Priests of Our Democracy, is published by NYU Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.